is Chris Main, M-A-I-N, and I'm with Major General N.H. Ross, R-O-S-S. And General Ross was with the the Cameron Highlanders of Canada. Not the Cameron Highlanders of Ottawa, but the Cameron Highlanders of Canada. And General Ross with General Canadian Forces. The date today is 20 July 1979, and we're at General Ross's home in Uplands, Victoria, on Uplands Drive. And first thing, General Ross, is that you have no reservations that this tape can be copied for the National Archives. And
no, not at all.
Thank you very much, sir. I was wondering if you could start, sir, by if you could tell us a bit about when and where you were born, and briefly about your family background.
Yes. I was born June the 5th, 1915, in Winnipeg, Manitoba. My father was a departmental manager in Teton Company in Winnipeg. Having migrated to Canada from Scotland, I think, about 1904, my mother came out from England in 1906, and they were married about 1910, I guess it was, somewhere around there. I was educated in Winnipeg. I went to St. John's College School, and from there did 2 years in university, and then was employed in an insurance company in Winnipeg in the investment department until war broke out in September 39.
No, you went, what, 2 years of university?
2 years.
And the university itself?
University of Manitoba.
In Winnipeg.
In Winnipeg.
Now, were you involved with cadets or anything like that?
At St. John's College School, it was compulsory, unless you were medically unfit, to be a member of the St. John's College School Cadet Corps. That was my first exposure to military, having no military background in the family at all.
And what was the Cadet Corps like at St. John's College?
Well, it was part of the as far as I can recall, it was part of the military cadet, Army cadet corps existent then throughout Canada.
It was obviously part of the curriculum then, is that?
Oh, it was definitely part of the curriculum. There's one afternoon or one after school afternoon, if you follow me, after 3 o'clock, parade a week where it was compulsory to attend. The parades were carried out in the usual, the final parade in the inspection in June was the white flannel trousers with the blazer with the little beanie cap on, the college or the school tie, and inspected by the district officer commanding of the then Military District Number 10, which was headquartered in Winnipeg. We had support from the regular, the permanent forces it was then called, in terms of an instructor.
You wouldn't have a cadet uniform.
No cadet uniform as such. Wait a minute, I'm sorry, we did. It was when we were little guys, we had the blazer and whatnot, but after a certain form, I forget what the form was, fifth form was the top form, I suppose it was about the fourth, the last 2 years, there was a uniform, and it was the little, as I recall, a dark blue with gold stripes or something down the pants and a little wedge cap. You're absolutely right. There was a uniform somewhere along the line. I probably produced pictures of this. This
had advanced corps buttons, or
I can't recall. I know there was a band, a bugle band, and not being at all musical, I always used to envy the cadets, my peers, I guess, who could toot and flute and the whistle sort of stuff, bang the drum.
What was your reaction to the cadet corps?
I enjoyed it. The master who was responsible for the training was an ex Englishman in the public school system in England. A real disciplinarian and up and down the ranks with a cane, and if you weren't behaving properly or doing as he thought you should do, you got a whack in the behind or something. But it was just part of to me, private school training, and you accepted it along with all the other discipline that went on in the school, such as, you know, the prefects having the right to cane you and this sort of stuff. It was normal discipline to us. And I rather enjoyed it, I suppose, because from there I joined the COTC at university, and then when I left, I had got my A, no, A and B certificate, I guess, out of the university, COTC, which meant I was qualified captain when I left COTC and went into the Cameron as a second lieutenant. And I was a lieutenant when war broke out in September of 39.
Okay, well, let's, at the University of Manitoba, there was a COTC there. Now, you joined that, what were your reasons for joining the cadet officer?
I suppose it was a follow-on from cadet training, a liking for military, I suppose, at that time. It appealed to me.
Was there any financial? I'm not saying you did that.
No, I'm just trying to recall whether we did get paid or not. So far back now, really. If we got paid, it was for 10 days. I think normal pay then was about 10 days pay a year. And we may have got 10 days as a officer cadet or whatever he got paid. I can't recall the financing being any reason for joining. I can't, as I say, recall whether we did in fact get paid. I'm not sure that we did. I know we got uniforms, the old World War One type of, as I recall, putties and you know, the brass button they had to shine and the little peak cap and the broad
khaki uniform.
Khaki, you know, with the broad belt, you know, the broad web belt. The old, well, the end of the World War One, I guess it was, and what the permanent force was then wearing.
Did you view yourselves as invincible at this time?
Oh, no, not at all. Of course, we were all too young to really take any broad view of it. We enjoyed it. We paraded Saturday mornings, as I recall, in Minto Armory.
What about the social life as an officer cadet at university? Did it
one social, and one really a parade, but it was a dinner dance at the Royal Alec Theatre, which was one of the highlights of the university, really, because it was a real bang-up affair. It was a great fun affair, let's put it this way.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, of course, there wasn't much money going around, so this wasn't a very expensive thing, or nobody would have attended it. But it was a good. That was the only social. That, of course, and the friends you made, like any other university activity, you made your friends in the groups that you associated with, whether you were in the literary class or a group or in the soccer or football or baseball, whatever it was, in the COTC, you tend to make friends there. This is the benefit of it, really. And a lot of my friends who were then in the COTC were later World War II, fellows like Ted Henselwood and Dunderdale and Gold and Norm Peterson, who was killed in the RCAF, Jimmy Whitecross, who was killed flying the RAF. These were all COTC colleagues of mine at the time.
Hmm. Now, what year are we talking here?
We're now talking, gosh, I can't put it right down, but we're now talking around 29, 32, somewhere in there. Plus or minus 1930 in that era, the early 30s.
So we're talking the early 30s.
Early 30s, yeah.
Now, just trying to think. Now, you finished what, a 2-year program?
I didn't finish university. I did not get a degree from university. I did 2 years in arts and science course, and then decided to hell with it and went to work in the investment department of the insurance company.
How did that go over at home?
Fine.
No difficulty
at all. Those days, you must remember, there was no great stress for everybody to be a university graduate. And in fact, it was considered not at all necessary to have a university degree to be quite successful.
More of a luxury item in the sense that we're talking Depression era in Canada. And if one could afford to go to university, that I gather one would stay there.
Except one had to have an aim for things. At that time, I had no aim as what I wanted. You know, I didn't want to be an engineer, didn't want to be a doctor, law didn't appeal to me, and things like that. So, what's the point of going to university to get an arts and science degree when really you didn't know what the hell you wanted to be? In fact, I suppose I was tending more and more to the military, to a military life than anything. And looking at it in hindsight, what I should really have done is gone to RMC, or applied for RMC is what I should have done. That's where I should
Did
have been.
Did you ever consider applying for RMC at this time?
Not at this time, no. By the time I, you know, really got serious about the military, it was later when I was working. I applied for a commission in the permanent force. I was serving the Camerons then, and, you know, working. And in fact, was offered a commission in '39. I guess about the spring of '39, in the permanent force. But it was obvious that war was breaking out, and I decided to hell with it. I'd stay with the Camerons and go fight a war with the Camerons rather than with some unit that I did not know.
Well, now how did you get tied up with the Cameron Highlanders? No.
Well, I suppose with a Scottish background, at one stage we lived out in West Kildonan, and there's a park, it's on the north side of Winnipeg, a park called Kildonan Park, and the story goes that I don't know, it must have been age 3, 4, or 5, somewhere in there, I was lost. And everybody out looking for me, and they eventually found me, the police found me out in Kildonan Park sitting listening to the Cameron Pipe Band.
Yeah.
I had followed it about 3 miles down Main Street to the Kildonan Park and was there listening to the pipes, and that's where they found me. So I don't know whether, you know, when you say why the Camerons, I suppose that because they were a Highland regiment. This is
sucker for the pipes.
Yeah, this is what drew me, and I don't know. One pipe tune from another, having followed them for over 20 years or so, but
Down the Brave and Round Bear.
Yeah,
and,
that's right. Yeah.
Pikes and Hot.
Highland Laddie.
Catch
and,
on the
yeah,
Rocks.
Yeah. All the rest.
That's but, great. Well, I'm just trying to get this in perspective here. You were working for an insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
You used to divulge which one?
Well, I don't think it's relevant, really.
Okay.
But it is a head office in Winnipeg, and I was in the investment department. No senior position. I was too bloody young or anything like that. I was learning business. That's all.
I'm just trying to think now. But you decided because of your interest. I'm trying to think how you got into the Camerons itself.
Oh, Cameron, of course, is a militia unit at that time.
Yeah, I understand.
And all I did from the COTC, I knew some of the Cameron officers, and. Said, you know, interested in joining, okay, fine. I don't know how they select officers or not, but I was, it was agreed that I would go into the Camerons, went in as a second lieutenant, and started off there with the Camerons.
Do you recall the date when you joined the Camerons?
No, I don't really.
Okay,
it would be about 1932, I guess, 33, somewhere in there.
32, 33
in that area, yeah.
Okay, now I got some good stuff for you. First of all, do you recall how large the unit was, the battalion was?
Oh, around between 150 and 200, I would say. That would include the band. Band probably around 30, 40. Like the militia is today, the militia was before the war, full complement of officers, full complement of NCOs, and a few privates. And this is true today, and it was true then. There's very little difference between militia in terms of strength, in terms of numbers,
mm-hmm.
now than when I was in it in the 30s.
Were you located in a barracks?
Minto Armories in Winnipeg.
Minto?
Armories. Was
Armory.
Our training, yeah.
Do you recall where that is where it was located? Or is it
Winnipeg there? West. It's north of Portage Avenue.
Okay. I just tried to...
Yeah.
Make sure now.
It's on Mental Street, I think.
Now, as a second Louis with the Camerons militia, now were you expected to purchase kilt and all these types of things? A dress uniform?
The officer had to equip himself. That meant you had to have black brogues, spats, hose top. Everything goes with it, a kilt, sporn, tunic, shirt, tie, Glengarry, Sam Brown, and a claymore.
You had to buy your own thing?
All had to be purchased.
see, would have no. Ski and do as well?
Ski and do.
And you would have to purchase a Claymore.
Claymore, yeah. No. That was essential. You had to have that. Oh, you also, of course, Winnipeg, you didn't wear a kilt all year round. Wore it on New Year's Day only in the wintertime, but so you had to have trews as well, the Cameron Tartan trews.
Cane?
Oh, cane, yeah, a swagger stick.
Stick or a cane?
No, it was a swagger stick we carried.
You actually carried a stick. It wasn't the old...
I'll show you.
Okay, take a buzz. We're back. Now, as the stick that I just saw would be a small swagger, but it'd have a pommel with the Cameron's...
Yeah, the Queen's Old Cameron Howler crest on it.
Crest on the pommel. Now, the claymore fascinates me. All officers had to have a claymore at this time.
Oh, yes.
And now it would be worn on the back or at the side?
Oh, the side, carried on your sambrav, used for all our ceremonial parades. All our parades are annual inspections and Armistice Day parades. And every time you went out carrying, dressed up in sambrav and sword, ordinarily, or the other troops, and we'd be carrying our claymore and wearing kilt.
That's super. I think that's just fascinating. This initial expense to outfit yourself, were you given an allowance, or were you just expected out of pocket?
No allowance. You were expected to provide this yourself, but there was tremendous assistance. Everybody realized that this was costly, and in those days money was hard to come by. In terms of officers retiring, officers no longer in the Cameron, but had some Cameron gear, would hand it in, and you would... they may want a couple of dollars for something that normally would cost you $50 or something mm-hmm. like that. Or they would hand it in. You'd go to the QM stores and the QM would say, well, okay, now here's something. Throw $5 into the regimental fund for this. And it was one way of raising money for the regiment, really, for the, mm-hmm. Keep the regiment going. That officers, when they were through, would donate their gear. And you go there and buy it for a very nominal fee. Equip yourself with that. And as you got better, as you were financially able to buy better things, then you would put yours in for some young officer joining to start off with. So this was, there was no compulsion to go to Aberdeen or Glasgow or Edinburgh to get equipped with totally new equipment sort of thing. We were not a wealthy regiment in terms of all officers being of money, heavily moneyed or something like that.
Mm-hmm. You would that be your dress uniform? What about your other?
Now we also had blue patrols, which meant that we had our trews, which we wore in the wintertime with our serge, but a blue patrol jacket, which again an officer was expected to buy a blue patrol jacket. This was worn, could be worn, mess dinners by junior officers. In other words, it was not an obligation to buy mess kit initially.
But
it was expected that you would have blue patrols to start off with. And this it was quite acceptable for newly joined officers to wear their blue patrols to mess functions.
Would there be the social, I guess, you'd be the only guy in blue patrol you would...
No, not at all, because there were always two, three, four newly joined officers in blue patrols, and nobody felt out of place, and they were not looked down upon or anything else like that.
Everyone was in the same boat.
And it was just happy to have you with us, and as soon as you can, as soon as you can find the money, get yourself a mess kit, was the attitude.
No compulsion. No, a mess kit would be difficult for second hand. I guess that would be tailor-made, is that not correct?
Pretty well, although... I forget whether I got mine made up or whether I got mine secondhand.
Now, would that be the standard?
That was the
red jacket.
The red jacket with the facing, with a vest, as I recall, stiff shirt.
Not a
cummerbund. No.
No cummerbund.
No. No.
What would as I recall. The color?
The facing. The facing.
So the lapel facings would have the color of what for the Cameron's uniform? Oh, I'm being picky, I know.
And if I can recall at this stage, whether it was gold, buff,
And I guess you'd have your one big pip on the shoulders.
I forget. Yes, the insignia was on the shoulder, as I recall. And this was worn with a stiff shirt and black bow tie.
And pants now, would they have the stripe?
With this, no. God, Cameron's never wore pants to start off with. We wore trues. We wore trues, and we didn't wear anything with stripes other than tartan. The mess kit could be worn with the mess jacket could be worn with trues, and generally was, particularly most of our parties, mess functions were in the winter time. Again, because of the expanse of the cost,
do you mind if I...
No, not at all. Because of the cost, few officers, certainly at my age and stage in the Camerons, had a complete mess kit. That is the dirk.
You would carry a dirk as well?
If you're properly dressed in mess kit. But at my age and stage, as I say...
I'm thinking of the long dirk. Is that correct? With the three...
the one yay long, carrying the...
On the side. Yeah.
Now, as I say, my age and stage, the officers like me, the more junior officers, still fighting your way to eke out a living, were not able financially to buy this. And again, there was no great compulsion. Mess parties, we went out in our mess jackets with trues. But the more senior officers were wearing kilt and dirk and the full regalia. Again, getting
it. Could there be a problem? I know we're concentrating on uniform here, but could there be a problem, say, that if one couldn't get a certain rank without the proper
Not
dress?
At all.
Not at all.
No, we were a very happy regiment, and as I say, one should appreciate these were most difficult financial times we're going through now. This is so-called Great Depression. And there was a great friendship amongst the officers in the regiment. And so long as you pulled your weight, did what you could, period, that's all that was expected of you. If you could afford to do a certain thing and you were not doing, then perhaps a little weight would be put on you to do what was expected. But I don't recall this ever happening. I don't recall any officer shirking in terms of doing what he could in terms of getting properly dressed.
Mm-hmm.
But it never looked down upon, nor did it ever hold anybody up from promotion that I know of.
Fair enough. Thank you, sir. I'm thinking now your pay would be turned into the regiment. Is that correct?
In the Camerons, and I'm sure this was true in most militia units of the time, I said previously, 10 days pay is what strikes me as being what was allowed those days for so-called training pay per year for the militia, 10 days pay. And for this, you had to complete so many hours training, as I recall, a day's training, I guess it was. Now, that pay in our case, nobody thought, not even a private in the Camerons. All pay went into regimental funds. All the 10 days training pay went into, and I'll say something with respect to other pay. But that 10 days pay went into, the annual training pay went into regimental funds. And out of that, in the Camerons, we, as I recall, trained Wednesday evenings. That was our regular training week. Our training program was Wednesday evenings at Minto Armories. And we trained, I forget when we started, but I know we ended up around 10 o'clock at night. And the band then would go take over the armory floor, and the band would play probably for half an hour, three quarters of an hour. And during this time, the six-foot folding table, the old army issue type, were put up. Coffee sandwiches were put out on the parade square, on the armory floor, and all the troops, officers included, would stand around and have a cup of coffee and a sandwich. From it, any soldier anybody who really needed carfare, who couldn't afford the carfare to get him to and from the armory, would go and be issued carfare. And there was never any question asked, do you really need this or don't you need it? And there was never any, to my knowledge, any abuse of this whatsoever. If a fellow really wanted it, bang, he went and got his car ticket. Nobody thought the less of him. Nor was there any question of anybody cheating or anything. It was there, period, for him to take if he really needed it. And also, I recall, some of the fellows, I suppose, I think it was called relief. There's no such thing as unemployment insurance then. Mm-hmm. Some of the soldiers who were on relief were given money, vouchers, I guess it was, to go buy themselves boots and things like that. And this is what regimental funds are all about.
To help those in the
help those in the regiment who otherwise didn't have the means of being a member of the Camerons. There was an annual picnic, sports picnic type of thing, which was again funded by regimental funds. There were, I think, funds provided to each company so that it could be a company smoker once a year, these funds mm-hmm. paid for everything, so there was no question of nobody being able to attend because they couldn't afford the admittance fee.
I'm thinking during the 30s as well, would there be, I'm trying to think how to phrase this. Okay, let's say there's a fellow in business in the regiment and then a private comes in or whatever, someone joins without a job or was laid off a job or whatever the reason, would there be an effort by the regiment for people with businesses in the regiment to provide employment for others?
I'm sure, again, the Camerons were no different to other units, and one of our majors was the plant superintendent, Canada Packers, in Winnipeg, and he in particular went out of his way to find employment at the plant for laddies who wanted to join the Camerons and were out of work, or were in the Camerons and were placed out of work whilst in the Camerons because their job folded up somewhere else. He would do his best to locate them in the plant, to the point where we had, I suppose, a high proportion of our soldiers and NCOs were employees of Canada Packers. This fellow is an ex-Scot serving the British, I think it was the Highland Light Infantry during World War I, a keen Scot. But he certainly was a strong supporter of the Camerons.
I'm thinking, in those terms, in that the regiment would look after its own.
Do everything possibly could to look after the members.
I know it's the 30s. I'm just thinking, say someone was, really on, not destitute, but very broke, would there be a little help along the financial?
I can't recall that. No, you must remember that I was a very junior officer,
I'm
certain payments may be made, or let's put it this way, maybe groceries, things like this were bought out of regimental funds for some member of the regiment. I suppose to let him retain his pride or things like this, it was only known maybe to the 2IC and the QM or somebody like this, so it wasn't generally known that old Joe is on the dole of the Cameron sort of stuff. And this may well have happened. But I was going to say that about the 10 days pay all going into regimental fund. The other pay that I was referring to is the pay that we used to get when we went to camp. We went to camp, I think it was 7 day camp. 6 or 7 day camp.
Out to Shiloh.
Out to Shiloh. And that pay, what you got paid for camp was yours, period. The theory being that a lot of the soldiers and some of the officers gave up work,
time
off work, for which they were not getting paid. And we encouraged them if their job possibly could, and many of them, their employer was quite happy to let them go away for a week without pay. It meant he could employ somebody else, or it may have been a slack period who was only keeping him on when really, there wasn't enough work. So some employers were happy to let them go for a week without pay, and some of the soldiers were happy to go to camp for a week knowing that they were going to get paid for or get their pay at that time. So that was the only occasion that we ever kept our pay was pay whilst at camp, summer camp.
At camp itself.
Yeah.
I'm thinking too, now in your case, did you have any difficulty getting away from your firm?
Well, obviously not, because I went to camp, so I can't recall whether I...
Okay.
No, I know I didn't have... I think I took my holidays, or yeah. I must have got a couple of weeks' holidays a year and took one to go in there. I'm not married, and no problem as far as I was concerned.
With the social life of the... I'm thinking of the officers of the cameras now. You're an officer. Would there be a mess in the Army itself?
No. There was in Winnipeg at that time, and right up till after World War II, three buildings on Main Street opposite the CNR station, Main and Broadway about. One was the regimental headquarters, Sergeant's Mess, Officer's Mess, of the Grenadiers, Winnipeg Grenadiers. One was the same for the Royal Winnipeg Rifles, and 202 Main Street was the Queen's Own Cameron Highlanders. And in it, we had our regimental headquarters in terms of the main orderly room being kept there, sergeant's mess and an officer's mess. And this is where we used to have most of our mess functions. We had a monthly dance, each month during the winter months. I don't recall exactly whether it starts September, October, and when it ended, maybe in March or April, something like that. And I recall that these were put on for $3 a couple, and that included music, which I'll explain later, a punch bowl, and coffee and sandwiches, around midnight at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, or one. Very small mess. But we had, it's one of the happy memories of my lifetime, certainly my association with military, is the parties we used to have at 202 Main Street. The music was a gramophone, didn't call them stereos, no such thing as stereo there, gramophone with records, single playing 78s, I guess they were. And the mass funds were sufficient that we could purchase 3 new records a month. And I say that because I recall two of us, another young officer, Dickie Rutherford, and I were on this committee to purchase records. And we bought Benny Goodman swinging Loch Lomond.
Oh my.
And that was played, or almost played, once in the mess. At an officer's mess dance. And Adur Scott stopped dancing, went over, lifted the thing, took that record, broke it over his knee. And that was the end of that. And then that was one third of our monthly budget gone. Didn't even go through once. Yeah.
Swinging Loch Lomond.
He wouldn't go for Loch Lomond and Benny Goodman.
King of Swing.
Yeah, but we had fun there, and as I say, very inexpensive if you wanted to buy.
Would you have pipies there as well?
The piper, let's see now, I usually pipe the, this is on the second floor of this building, used to pipe the CO and his wife party up the stairs, and I think the piper did play for Highland Dancing. As I recall.
I'm just wondering if you had Highland Dancing at these functions.
We did, but it was not like some Scottish regiments where Highland Dancing was a compulsory activity for junior officers. In our regiment, we did, and I never did, for instance, learn Highland Dancing. I'm no great dancer at any stage, but never did learn to perform. Yeah. But I can recall some of the older officers and their wives, particularly those of Scottish background, at least one or two dances a night were Highland dancing, so the piper must have stayed on for that.
What about the ethnic makeup now? Winnipeg is there's Ukrainian, large Jewish community, Ukrainian, Slav, you name it. Was your regiment mostly Scottish descended, or were there?
We're going before the war.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the majority of officers were of Scottish background, one way or another. But not exclusive. A lot of the NCOs, senior NCOs, were again of Scottish background, probably having served in Scottish regiments during World War I.
Mm-hmm.
This is true of a lot of the senior officers I'm talking about now, the senior captains and majors probably had served in Scottish Highland units during World War I. Some of them, of course, had served in the Camerons in World War I, Canadian Highland Regiment. The men were a mixed lot in terms of, and the more junior NCOs. And I can't recall them being mainly of Scottish background, but they may have been, because it would be natural, I suppose, for any laddie of Scottish background who's going to join the militia to join the Camerons,
mm-hmm.
rather than the Winnipeg Rifles or the Grenadiers and things like that. So I think it would be a fair assumption that most of our or a fair percentage of them mm-hmm. were background. Now, this wasn't true when war broke out and during World War II. The makeup changed completely.
Back to the social life of the Camerons itself. There would be the dance in the winter once a month. There would be, as you say, a smoker once a year for the companies. There would be a New Year's levee.
Oh yeah, we have New Year's dance, of course. Yeah. New Year's Eve dance, and then the New Year's Day levee, which would start around 9:30 in the morning and end up whenever you wanted to wind it up in the afternoon or evening. And that was pretty well a must for every officer to we started at Government House in Winnipeg, and then that was the must was the Government House, and the must was the time that the Camerons were receiving. Then what an officer did after that, whether he called in all the other regiments and things, that was up to him.
Would there be much social exchange of things like with the Grenadiers?
Oh yes.
With the PPC line, Winnipeg didn't have
the Patricias were out at Fort Osmond Barracks. Yeah, you know. They were out there.
And there'd be a detachment of the Signals there.
It's a very small detachment,
yeah.
SIGs, maybe one or two officers. I don't recall
mm-hmm.
any SIGs officers, but certainly Lord Strathcona Horse were there, and C Battery of the RCHA were out in Fort Osborne.
Fort Garry Horse?
They were not permanent force. Fort Garry's were another militia. They had their headquarters in, they didn't have there were only the three infantry battalions had separate messes. The Fort Garry's.
Wasn't there a garrison there? I'm trying to think of Winnipeg at this time.
A garrison?
In the sense that a lot of regiments would be using the one area.
Minto Armories.
The Armories.
Minto Armories, and then at McGregor Armories, north end of Winnipeg, was Winnipeg Light Infantry. This was their headquarters and had their messes there.
I'm just wondering with all these regiments.
Gunner regiment.
I'm just thinking with all these regiments and the, you know, as you say, the RCA and all these people, would there be much exchange socially, and would you have like mess dinner once a week type of thing?
Oh no. Nobody could afford a mess dinner once a week. We had a mess dinner once a year, I think it was. That's all you could afford. But there's also the annual military ball, which held for. No, Royal Alexander Hotel in Winnipeg. And that was the great occasion where every military officer was there with a wife or girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
But there was, as you say, exchange. You got to know practically every other officer in Winnipeg. You'd meet them on the rifle ranges. You'd meet them in competitions. You'd
mm-hmm.
meet them, their mess, your mess.
What about Government
parades.
House? You mentioned the levy on Government House. Now, would there be a great... would you be invited a lot, like say the Government House function and things?
Never.
Never.
Not as a junior officer. No, the CO may have been invited, I don't know. But good God, no. I was there once a year.
New Year's Day. New Year's Day like everybody else.
Yeah, sure.
No, I was just thinking if there would be, how should I put this, I guess support from Government House for the militia and things.
Well, again, you see, you're talking at a stage when I was a very junior officer,
no,
and if the lieutenant governor was in fact giving a lot of support to militia, I probably wouldn't be aware of it. The CO certainly would have been, but I wouldn't have been aware of it at that stage. I really wasn't.
Yours was not to reason why.
Why? Three bags full, sir. You know?
Okay.
Yeah.
Sports in the regiment, I gather, would be a major concern. Would there be higher
not really.
Sports?
Or? No, not really. Here. No, we did not have any sports organized as such by the regiment. Again, you must realize that from the whole of Winnipeg, or the greater Winnipeg area, very difficult to get fellows to come in, say, to have a softball team or a hockey team and things like this. And again, the expense involved and the time involved, I suppose, most of us put our time into purely military matters, and the sports activities were left for fellows to get into their own communities. I played hockey and baseball and things like that, but not with Cameron, with groups of in my own community.
In Scottish had a famous rugby team.
Could well have been.
I just assumed that it would be standard. That's interesting.
No, not necessarily. And you'll find, you talk to people from 15 different regiments, you'll find that you've got 15 different modes of operation of life. And
sports weren't the...
Weren't the be-all and end-all, no.
Because I know on this coast, at this time, sports was the great incentive to get people in. Was like a lot of, like General Rockingham, for example, got into the Scottish by his sports as opposed to other concerns. I think we've pretty much covered them all. Is there any other purely social thing that the regiment used to, I guess the band would be playing quite often?
Oh yes, the band was in demand all the time. The band was playing around Winnipeg and the first class pipe band. That was the days before everybody had a pipe band. I suppose during the spring, summer, a lot of us used to spend our Saturday afternoons out at St. Charles Rifle Range, which is out West Winnipeg, now called Headingley, St. Charles Rifle Range, did a lot of shooting. Cameron's spent a lot of time. When you say sports, I suppose this is an activity that we took on rather than sports. Won a lot of trophies, Eaton Cup, marching, firing competitions, things like that.
What kind of weapons did you have?
Oh, it's the old 303 Lee Enfield.
You had the Lee Enfield?
Oh, yeah.
What about ammunition? Did you buy it yourself?
Oh, no. Ammunition was always available. I don't recall. Yes, as far as I can recall, it was plentiful. I don't recall anybody saying we only have 5 rounds today or things like that. It was get all the fellows out you can, go through classifications. And we were not a pot-hunting regiment. And I don't say this disparagingly, but the Royal Winnipeg Rifles had some first keen Bisley shots, Burton and Gamble and fellows like this. They tended to concentrate their effort on a few good shots, and they had some good shots. Maybe because we couldn't produce Bisley type things, that we concentrated more on regimental shooting rather than on what we used to call pot hunters.
Why would you call them pot hunters?
Because they never attended parades or anything else. All they were in the regiment for was shooting, period. Their be all and end all was shooting, and they were kept on the regimental strength and supported by the regiment, so the regiment would get a recognition for having these pot hunters, as we called them. We would not, my regiment wouldn't have a pot hunter. You attended parades, period. And if you were a good shot, that was great. But you had to
fight for that's great, too.
Yeah, but you had to be soldier first and shoot.
Like the Gurkhas?
Shoot as a soldier, let's put it this way, not as a pot hunter.
Well, that's the way the Gurkhas operate. Say all their pipers are soldiers first and marksmen first, and then they can pipe, as opposed to say like the Coldstream, permanent band.
No, I don't say this disparagingly, but it was just a way that we operated at that time.
Like
yeah, that's right.
Now the Bisley Cups, and that's the major one in England. Is where they
Shooting for it. They were shooting for it last week. I don't know if it's over yet or not. I haven't seen results, but Canada had won a cup, I think it was last week or something.
What about tattoos and that sort of stuff?
Don't recall those being held at all. you know, there's, again, one must remember, these things are costly, in terms of getting mm-hmm. people together. And anything that required money in those days was hard to put on. And a tattoo cost money.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking that you're a Highland regiment, though. Would you be coerced into Highland games, or were they not common?
They were not common. I don't recall Highland games being held in Winnipeg in my time. Now, St. Andrew's Society and Burns and all the sorts of things, Caledonian Society, Winnipeg, whenever they had picnics and things, the Cameron Pipe Band would be out, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
your PR people, I guess, were the pipe band, is that correct?
That's right, exactly. Exactly right. No.
To
and also the parades we used to do, go swinging down the streets and avenues of Winnipeg and kilt and the band and things like this. That was PR in itself. And sometimes good, sometimes bad.
So what were the relations like community-wise, Winnipeg with
Well,
Cameron?
Again, Cameron not bad, but again in those days, you must remember that I recall particularly North End, a soldiers' militia, non-permanent active militia as it was called. In the North End, the Winnipeg Light Infantry and the gunners who were up there, a lot of the lads would have to go to the armory in civilian clothes and dress there, or they get beaten up on the streets. Or they would go gather at one person's house and get dressed in the uniform there and walk down the street in a group of five or six.
What
carrying bandoliers in their hand, you know, the gunners, their leather bandoliers they wore across their shoulders, carrying those probably with sand
just
or something.
Just because of the general
the anti-military feeling that went through Canada, and it was particular in the north end of Winnipeg where there was a large...